fantastic. Okay. I'm adequately mic'd. I can hear myself echoing in the space. I like to sit down here at the front of the room because I feel like this is a huge space for all of us, and this way I feel like I'm more with you. I didn't change the front page of my talk, but I did change quite a bit on the inside, so anybody who's seen the old slides, some of these are the same and some of them are different. The idea of this kind of lecture structure that we've revised this year is to combine a little bit of clinical perspective and a little bit of treatment perspective for a variety of heme malignancies with some research perspective to kind of give you guys an opportunity to think about what you can add to the field. In terms of me, as you all know, I'm a clinical leukemia person, but I also have a laboratory, and really what we do is Dr. Nemeth and I, we collaborate very extensively on a variety of different projects, and he's going to talk about one of those as we go forward. But that's what I want you to think about as we're thinking about this lecture and about what we're talking about. So in terms of estimated U.S. cancer cases, leukemia is relatively rare, right? There are about 20,000 cases of acute myelogenous leukemia diagnosed every year. There are about 7,000 new cases of acute lymphoblastic leukemia diagnosed every year. About the same, about 20,000 cases of myelodysplastic syndrome diagnosed each year, slightly less. Leukemia is shown up here, about 3% of all adult cancers in men, and it's lumped into here in women, so relatively less common in women. In terms of mortality, however, what you can see here is that it tends to rank relatively highly, and that's because this is a really devastating disease. In the absence of therapy, acute myeloid leukemia, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, these diseases are universally fatal within a very short period of time, within weeks to months sometimes within days. And that's because of the underlying characteristics of the disease, which we'll touch on. So when we think about blood cancer or leukemias, for example, leuk meaning white and emia meaning blood, right? So historically, these patients would present with pallor and present with very pale-looking blood. And that's because they just stopped making red cells, white cells, and platelets. Under normal circumstances, your bone marrow stem cells are born with you. They live with you your whole life. You're born with a certain number of them. And as we age, we lose about 1% of our cancer stem cells per year. Now, Dr. Nemeth will talk about relative replication frequency of these cells, but they replicate very infrequently. When they replicate, we leave one putatively normal stem cell, and the rest grow up to be adult cells, and these become progenitors, and then they divide to make all of the red cells, white cells, and platelets that you require every day. Remember, you replicate all of your red cells once every 120 days. That means that every one day, you need to make one 120th of your total red cell volume to replace what's been lost and taken out of circulation. Your white cells live on average about 9 to 12 days, and your platelets live about 9 days. And this duration of expectancy of life can be decreased pretty markedly in the context of infection. So if you get an infection, the life expectancy of your white cells can go down quite significantly, and as also your platelet count. These normal cells grow up, they're produced, and so the hematopoietic tissue is actually the most frequently turning over tissue in your body. And so a lot of the sequelae that we see with chemotherapy is visited on the hematopoietic system. And that's why you see cytopenias. When you develop a mutation or some kind of event that results in inappropriate longevity or cell division of this cell, you get a cancer stem cell which can then produce bulk tumor. So blood cancers are normal blood cells that have gone bad. And this is the normal hierarchy of hematopoiesis. We talked about myeloid leukemias versus lymphoid leukemias. And we say that we make this designation largely based on what the cells look like under the microscope, what surface markers they express, and what they express on their cell surface in a way we can test with flow cytometry. We'll talk about that in a moment. So when you think about blood cancer, you can think about myeloid cancers versus lymphoid cancers. Now, I know Dr. Hernandez will talk a little bit about lymphoid cancers, particularly the more mature lymphoid cancers. Historically, in this lecture, I covered a spectrum of different hematologic diseases, and I covered all of these things in one lecture, which was rather overwhelming. Today, I'm going to really focus on more of the myeloid diseases, acute myeloid leukemia, and the myelodysplastic syndrome, which constitutes the vast majority of my clinical practice. We're not going to talk that much about acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and I don't know if Dr. Hernandez will cover it either. It's important to know that this is a more rare form of hematologic leukemia in adults, okay? It tends to be the most common type of leukemia in children. In children, it tends to be very well treated, and about 90% of all ALLs in kids can be cured nowadays with with chemotherapy regimens and or bone marrow transplantation. This is not going to be on the exam, just for the sake of general knowledge, okay? In adults, AML is the more common disease, and so we're going to talk about that a little bit more. So bone marrow in adults largely is in the sternum, it's in your vertebral bodies, it's in your shoulders, it's in the large bones of your hips and your pelvis, and it's in the long bones of your legs. You think of this space as a garden, okay? And when you develop problems in your garden, you see a deficiency of cells at the grocery store in the peripheral blood. In order to assess patients for hematologic malignancy, we often do a bone marrow biopsy because sometimes patients will actually present with inadequate cells in the peripheral blood. So you'll see complete deficiency of cells. The patient will have a low white cell count, a low hemoglobin, a low platelet count. And in that context, you want to know, is this as a result of weeds overgrowing the space in the bone marrow that are pushing out normal production? Or is this as a result of inadequate cells in there in the first place? That's aplastic anemia. This can happen from a variety of different causes. Infection can cause pancytopenia, as we call it. So it's necessary to do a bone marrow biopsy. So we stick a large needle into the hip bone, generally in the back of the person, have them lie on their side, and then we aspirate some of this bone marrow specimen out, and we look at it. And if you see a whole bunch of cells that all look the same under the microscope, we call that acute leukemia. In normal circumstances, your bone marrow should look very pretty. It should be many different colors and shapes, and looks a little bit more like this. I hope everybody can appreciate that these two things look different. Yeah? Yes? They are. They are, usually. So a majority of the time we do our bone marrow biopsies just under local anesthetic. Sometimes people have had bad experiences or people who've been extensively exposed to the medical community want to be put to sleep, and we can do it under conscious sedation as well. But, I mean, it's really not that bad, and it's not a bad... I'm sorry? Well, there are risks, of course, right, to anything. So if I put somebody to sleep, there's a risk they could aspirate, they could die from that. So anytime you decide to do something, you have to be aware of the potential risks versus the benefits. Right? If I sedate you, then you're asleep for the rest of the day. You might not pay attention. You might not be able to do things. If I just give you lidocaine, you get up, you can go for a walk, you can go with your family. These things are important. Okay, so in order to make a diagnosis of a blood cancer, the first thing we look at is the morphology. How do the cells look under the microscope? So this is just, we take a sample, we put it on a glass slide, we smear it out, and we stain it, usually using H&E, but we have a variety of different stains that we can use. And then we ask the question, what's the morphology of the specimen? The second thing we can do is look at abnormal protein expression or even normal protein expression using flow cytometry or histochemistry. Historically, this was in leukemia, these were the several histochemistry studies. We would do a study to look at nonspecific esterase, and we would look at myeloperoxidase, and these were actually enzyme studies that you could do on the slide, and that gives you a sense of whether or not the cell that you see under the microscope that does look undifferentiated is trying to grow up to be a myeloid cell or a lymphoid cell. But these are a little bit less reproducible, and so they've kind of fallen out of favor. The third thing we look at very frequently, very, very important in leukemia, is chromosomal abnormalities. Chromosomal abnormalities or cytogenetics or karyograms are, in fact, the most important prognostic factor that we have in the diagnosis and management of patients with MDS and acute myeloid leukemia. And then we look at specific gene mutations using sequencing techniques and using PCR techniques. All of these are very important for us. So how do we treat these? We can give cytotoxic chemotherapies. Sometimes we use an allogeneic stem cell transplant or an autologous stem cell transplant. And recently, we started to use what we call biologic therapies, and these can be receptor tyrosine kinase inhibitors, so blockers of specific mutational events. They can be antibody therapies, so things that actually bind a specific protein on the surface of the cell. We have now immunomodulatory agents, things like lenalidomide, which we'll talk about in a moment, and differentiation agents, which I'll also talk about. So leukemia cells express many, many different abnormal growth receptors which promote growth. So classically, we think about things like BCR-ABL, which is characteristic of the disease chronic myelogenous leukemia, but is actually also seen rarely, but also seen in patients with acute myelogenous leukemia at initial presentation. It can also be seen in patients with lymphoblastic leukemia. And historically, this is actually deemed a very, very high-risk group of patients. People who have BCR-ABL mutations tend to do very badly. But these days, with the advent of receptor tyrosine kinase inhibitors that target BCR-ABL, we can actually give chemotherapy in combination with cytotoxic therapies, and we can achieve remission in a much larger percentage of patients. And many of these patients end up doing extraordinarily well. JAK2 signaling. It's been about 10 years of JAK2, of the identification of JAK2 as being a common molecular feature of polycythemia vera, essential thrombocythemia, and myeloproliferative neoplasms, myelofibrosis, for example. Targeting of JAK2 is really in its infancy at this point, but we are continuing to target these for a variety of different malignancies. FLT3, I think, is really coming to the fore. We'll talk about that. This is a common mutational event that results in upregulated FLT3 signaling. This is a stem cell marker, which normally is confined to the hematopoietic stem cell compartment. But in the case of leukemia, mutations in FLT3 confer a very significant growth advantage. And targeting this mutation can actually overcome the adverse risk factor of having a mutation in FLT3. The BCR-ABL T315I mutation, this is a mutation that is actually resistant to a majority of tyrosine kinase inhibitors, something we need to know about. Mutations in c-KIT and upregulation of c-KIT, also common. All of these result in inappropriate activation and overgrowth, resulting in too many leukemia cells. Right? So inhibitors of these specific growth receptors can inhibit leukemia, and so we have a variety of them. So you can see here sort of a spectrum of things that are being used to target leukemia. So in AML and FLT3, we have a variety of different agents that are being actively developed for the treatment of patients with AML, either alone or in combination. In ALL, we often will have Philadelphia chromosome-positive disease. These patients often receive dasatinib or imatinib up front. They can also receive nilotinib. For some patients, we have a new drug, a fourth-generation tyrosine kinase inhibitor called ponatinib, which has been developed. In CML, again, BCR-ABL is a common feature. And in myelofibrosis and in patients with now polycythemia vera and perhaps even ET, we also have medications that target JAK2 signaling. So for patients who have high-grade disease or people whose cytogenetics confer an adverse prognostic factor, or for people who've progressed on primary therapy, we often will offer allogeneic bone marrow transplant. And I would argue that this is, in fact, the oldest form of immunotherapy. So immunotherapy is sort of the new hot thing, and it's been sort of the advent of the last few years. But I would say that, in fact, allogeneic bone marrow transplant, which is quite old, at least 50 years old now, is really the oldest form of immunotherapy. And this is the idea here is that we find a compatible donor stem cell source, and then we give this stem cell source to the patient. And this can be allogeneic, that is to say, from one person to another. It can be autologous in the case where the disease is intrinsically chemotherapy sensitive and the problem is that there's too much bone marrow toxicity from giving the dose of chemotherapy that you need to give in order to overcome the drug resistance of the underlying disease. This is often the case for lymphoid malignancies, particularly myeloma and patients with lymphoma. Syngeneic transplant would be if you had an identical twin. And when you think about a syngeneic transplant, people often think, oh, that would be the ideal bone marrow, right? It would be the ideal thing to give. But when you think about it, if I give you a syngeneic transplant, what I'm doing is I'm giving you the same immune system that you currently have, just clean of disease. And so the immunotherapy component of the transplant is therefore not present because there is no graft versus host effect. There is no graft versus leukemia recognition because essentially what I'm giving you is a clean autologous transplant, right? So a syngeneic transplant turns out to be less effective for diseases where what you need is an anti-leukemic effect from the graft, where you need an immunotherapy approach. Before you get your transplant, you need to condition the patient to accept the new graft, right? And for an autologous transplant, essentially what you're doing is high-dose chemotherapy of whatever type you think is required to address the primary malignancy, and then you give a stem cell rescue afterwards. For people who get an allogeneic transplant, what you don't want to do is immunosuppress the patient so that they're going to accept the graft. And these days, we often will do even less immunosuppression than we used to. And we can do such a thing called haploidentical transplant, where you give a patient a transplant from somebody who's not a complete match. And then you want to look at the immunologic consequences of this process. So graft versus host disease versus graft versus leukemia effects. Graft versus host disease is a devastating consequence of allogeneic transplant, right? If you get graft versus host disease, patients present with rashes, with pulmonary symptoms, they present with liver disease, they can have GI GVHD, which can cause liters of diarrhea, inadequate ability to manage your nutrition. All of these things come from the friendly fire of the transplant, the immunologic effect of the transplant. You need a little bit of it, because if you have none, in fact, the risk of the disease coming back is higher. But you don't want too much, because graft versus host disease is the other thing that competes to cause mortality in these patients who get an allotransplant. So this is how we get the blood stem cells. You can see them. We can get them either from the bone directly, so you can do a bone marrow harvest, or you can get them through the peripheral blood, and we cause them to come out of the bone marrow by giving shots of G-CSF. This is how we do it. This is the idea of a self bone marrow transplant. So you harvest from the patient the cells, you put them in a bag, you give some significant therapy, what I talked about before, and then you give the cells back. This is from somebody else. You treat the patient, chemo or radiation, you harvest stem cells from the donor, and then you give the patient the donor stem cells. This is the idea. These are just silly pictures. I've already kind of covered these. So when you think about types of leukemia, you think about acute leukemias, which are fast-growing, versus chronic leukemias. Very often my patients ask me, so, doc, I have this problem. You're calling it acute leukemia. What stage is it? Right? In solid tumors, we have this very clear idea. Stage one is early, stage two is bigger, stage three and stage four, those are later problems, right? In leukemia, it's a little harder to wrap your mind about. So what I say to patients is that acute leukemia is a little like pregnancy. You either got it or you don't, okay? Nobody laughed, that wasn't funny anymore. So, okay, acute leukemia is just that, it's acute. It shows up over nothing. A month ago, you did not have the disease, and today you do, okay? And if we looked for it a month ago, if we did deep sequencing in your bone marrow, we might have found it, but not necessarily. And right now, today, if we do nothing, that disease is 100% fatal, okay? Chronic leukemias you can live with for a while. So CML takes years to kill you. If you get a CML diagnosis, it will kill you over time if you do nothing, okay? But CML takes 8 to 10 years to do you in. And what happens usually is you get additional mutations and then you get an acute myeloid leukemia transformation or acute lymphoblastic leukemia transformation of your CML, okay? Acute lymphoblastic leukemia, ALL, also will kill you in relatively short order. In fact, it can be very dramatic. Whereas chronic leukemia, chronic CLL, the patients can live with this for many years and many people don't require any treatment at all for the whole of their duration. People will die with rather than of their disease, all right? And that's sort of the distinction between chronic and acute leukemia. And when you think about leukemia, that's how you want to think about it. Is it a slow-growing one, or is it a fast-growing one? Do we have to do something about it tonight, or can we wait till tomorrow, or the next day, or next week? So, I understand all of you have read Dr. Mukherjee's book, The Emperor of All Maladies. So, his description was very apt. A cancer of the whole of the white blood cells in one of its most explosive, violent incarnations. Its pace, its acuity, its breathtaking, inexorable arc of growth forces rapid, often drastic decisions. It's terrifying to experience, terrifying to observe, and terrifying to treat. The body invaded by leukemia is pushed to its brittle physiological limit. Okay? And what he's describing is that as the leukemia cells explode in a patient's body, you can actually see the organs begin to fail. The leukemia cells overgrow the bone marrow space. They start to take up space in the peripheral blood. They cause traffic jams in the small vascular circulation. People can become short of breath as a result of this because, in fact, the blood becomes thick in the lungs, becomes thick in the brain, slows in the kidney. People get acute renal failure from all of these things together. The cells outgrow their blood supply. They die. They release into circulation all of the DNA building blocks, which are then cleared, which are being tried to be cleared by the kidney, which then fails. Sometimes leukemia can actually form tumors, which can grow in the mediastinum and can press on important vascular organs and impress on the trachea. This can be incredibly devastating, and this can happen overnight. Somebody who was completely well 2 or 3 weeks ago can be on the point of dying within 2 weeks. The common symptoms of leukemia are pretty nonspecific. So most of my patients, when they come in, they say, you know, doc, I just didn't feel right. I was maybe more tired than usual. I'm a little bit more short of breath when I go up the stairs. Sometimes people have fever. This can actually be from the disease itself. Sometimes people can feel overwhelmingly weak, so I just feel not up to scratch. People complain of bone or joint pain. I have a patient who showed up. She was otherwise completely well, 35-year-old woman. She went into her doctor because she was being wakened in the night with extraordinary, excruciating knee pain. The doctor did an x-ray of her knee. It was completely unremarkable. She had knee pain. Just on the top of her knees, it would wake her up from sleep and she would cry out in the night. She had acute leukemia. The rest of her hemogram was completely normal. It was a relatively early presentation. People can have lymph node swelling, particularly in lymphoblastic leukemias. You can have lymph node involvement. One can often have spleen or liver involvement, so expansion. These two organs were the source of hematopoiesis embryologically, and so they're a natural reservoir for leukemias. You can have night sweats, easy bruising and bleeding, so people can have petechial rashes, red spots on their legs or their hands, and also petechiae in the mouth. Often, patients presenting with acute promyelocytic leukemia will actually have bleeding in their teeth, so when you brush your teeth, the teeth might bleed, or when you floss, that's a common symptom. So AML, under the microscope, what you see are large cells. These cells are bigger than red cells under the microscope, so this is a peripheral blood smear. See that these cells are large. They have scanty cytoplasm here. Often they'll have an hour rod, which is just an accretion of, concretion of the normal granules that are present within neutrophils. They tend to line up and coalesce like this. AML, again, can come either from these progenitors, monoblastic progenitors, myeloblastic progenitors, and proerythroblastic progenitors. They can also come from megakaryocyte progenitors. If you have a leukemia arising from a lymphoblastic progenitor, then it's from a lymphoid progenitor, that's going to differentiate into ALL. A majority of the patients who present are older, right? So the median age, actually, of acute leukemia, if you look at the 2016 projected SEER data, is 67. Many of my patients are actually extraordinarily old. I have a patient who I'm treating right now who's 94. We now understand a little bit better about what this is from, right? If you look and you do large population studies of molecular profiling, what you see is that as we age, the number of people who have clonal hematopoiesis increases very markedly, such that when you're in your 80s and 90s, about 20% of people will have clonal hematopoiesis. Now, that first hit, DNMT3A mutations, for example, or TET2 mutations, can have absolutely no sequelae. The CBC can be completely normal. But if you get a second hit, that can result in a leukemic transformation event. Okay? And that's probably what's happening here. Over the course of your life, you get exposed to something that hits a stem cell at some point, which results in a relative survival advantage for that particular clone, which can then be hit when you get a second exposure. Right? That's the mechanism of this. We have another peak in people who are very young, so in children. Probably a different disease, right? Probably a disease that arises as some genetic hit. The majority of these patients actually have better risk cytogenetic abnormalities. It's a little bit of a different disease. I think of these as cockroachy leukemias, okay? They've survived everything else, and now they're showing up later on. So acute myeloid leukemia, as I said before, most common type of acute leukemia in adults, the median age is 67. A projected incidence, about 19,000 cases, with a mortality rate about 50%. This is rapidly growing over days to weeks. These patients can present with infection or bleeding or bruising, fatigue. This can arise in the context of a prior hematologic diagnosis. So a lot of my patients actually have had previous therapy for a lymphoma or previous therapy for breast cancer. What we know from the large breast cancer registries where they look at 20 or 30,000 people is that the incidence of getting a secondary malignancy from the chemotherapy from your breast cancer, you guys remember from my lecture, exposure to anthracyclines, exposure to cytoxin can result in increased risk of leukemia. It's about 0.5%. Okay, so not a huge number, but if you think about all the many thousands of people who are treated for breast cancer each year, that number can add up. Radiation, prior radiation exposure is also a significant risk factor. So when we think about prognostic factors in this disease, we think a lot about cytogenetics. So it turns out cytogenetics are critical. You guys all know about cytogenetics. Anne-Marie has done a fantastic job instructing all of you. But in fact, cytogenetics are the most important prognostic feature for our patients with AML. The second thing that we care a lot about are gene mutational events, and we're appreciating a lot more the sequelae of these mutational events, and we're doing more and more large-scale gene profiling on our patients. But right now, the ones that are clinically used all the time are evaluation of the gene for FLT3, evaluation of the gene for NPM1, and the evaluation of the gene for CEBP-alpha. And it turns out that these are important prognostically. Clinical features that are important are age, the performance status. So this is exactly what it sounds like. How well can the patient perform? How well can they get up from their chair and walk across the room? How sick are they? Do they spend their day in the chair? Do they spend their day in the bed? Are they up and about? Are they walking every day? Are they marathon runners? This makes a big difference into how well the patient can tolerate chemo. Prior hematologic diagnosis tends to be associated with poor prognosis. Again, this is more like what you think about when you think about cockroachy diseases, right? If it comes from something that's been there a long, long time, it's had the opportunity to learn, it's had the opportunity to figure out how to survive. It's a bit more canny. We think about therapy-related leukemias. These tend to be more troublesome, harder to treat, harder to get into remission, tend to come back more frequently. And patients who have very high white cell counts, tend to relapse more because maybe those white cells hide in immunologically privileged sites, things like inside the CNS, inside the testes in men. These tend to be patients who have a worse prognosis. So this is a picture of a normal male karyogram. You guys have all seen this before, I'm sure. In fact, about 50% of all acute myeloid leukemia will have a normal karyotype. Okay? When you think about this, we look at leukemia risk categories. So in AML, the European Leukemia Net guidelines have been very rapidly adopted. And so we divide these patients into patients with favorable risk, into intermediate risk, and into adverse risk. And when we think about these patients, we start by looking at the good risk leukemia. So I always like to focus on good risk. When we think about good risk, we have what we call the core binding factor leukemias, which tend to be very chemotherapy sensitive. These patients, if you treat them with chemotherapy only, induction chemotherapy followed by consolidation, these patients will achieve remission about 60 or 70% of the time, and they will survive. At least 50 to 70% of them will be alive and in remission 5 years after you treat them with chemo alone. So that's what we call good risk in this disease. If you have normal karyotype with a mutation in the gene for NPM1, this is a nuclear pore, that's FLT3 ITD negative, these patients tend to do relatively well. Again, about 50, 60% of patients will be alive and in remission with chemotherapy alone. And with normal karyotype, double mutations in CBP alpha are associated with a better risk prognosis. Again, about 50, 60% long-term survival. We use 5 years as a surrogate for long-term. Intermediate risk disease includes all these normal karyotype patients who have mutations in one or both of these genes that I talked about here. And intermediate 2 patients, slightly worse than intermediate 1, translocation of T911, this is an MLL translocation, which generally is a worse prognosis mutation. Anything involving MLL, we think about it as being a bad risk, but it turns out that 911 translocations are slightly less bad than the rest of the mutations involving MLL. And we put here sort of a basket for anything else we don't know or that's not frequently seen enough to identify prognostic features. And then adverse risk is anything involving chromosome 3. It turns out that if you have a chromosome 3 abnormality, these patients tend to do incredibly poorly. A majority of them are dead by 6 months, no matter what you do, no matter how young they are, no matter how good their otherwise performance. Something about chromosome 3 is terribly bad. MLL rearranged leukemias, chromosome 5 or 7 abnormalities, chromosome 17p abnormalities, and complex karyotype disease. These tend to be pretty poor in terms of prognosis. And then the rest we group is intermediate. And if you look here, you can see prognostic features of these divisions, right? So if you look at good risk, favorable disease, we're talking about 50 or 60% long-term survival, long ways out, versus poor risk disease, we're looking at more at less than 20% five-year survival. And within this karyotype, within this unfavorable group, there are people who have particularly poor prognosis, which we'll talk about. So what do we do with these patients? Number one, we want to treat them and stabilize them so they don't die today of their disease, right? So when they walk in the door to me, the patients are actively trying to die from their disease. It is my job to prevent that from happening, okay? That sounds dramatic, but in fact, it is the truth. So you have to make a decision. Is the patient treatable? Are they young and healthy? Can I go ahead with full dose chemotherapy? Are they old? Do I need to think seriously about whether or not treatment is appropriate for that patient or if I should let them go? So we think about high treatment, low treatment, or no-go treatment, okay? We want to treat them with induction. So we want to get the patient into CR and to re-achieve normal hematopoiesis. And then post-remission, once we achieve CR, we want to prevent relapse and consolidate that remission. And then you want to ask yourself the question, do we need to send the patient for an allogeneic or an autologous stem cell transplant? I'll touch briefly on these phases of treatment, but generally induction therapy is chemotherapy that we give over the course of about a week. It's high-dose chemotherapy. It's like napalm. It should be killing everything. Once we kill everything, what we hope grows back is a more normal quality stem cell, right? Because we hope that the leukemia cells are less fit, fundamentally less fit than your endogenous stem cells, than your normal stem cells, okay? So that's the principle. You kill everything, you let it all grow back, you do a bone marrow. If the bone marrow shows less than 5% leukemia cells and the patient has normal cell counts in the peripheral blood, we call that remission. All right. What we know is that you start out with about a liter bag full of leukemia in your body. At the time the patient achieves remission, you have an eyedropper full. But if you do nothing, that eyedropper full will reconstitute the entirety of the disease. Right? The disease will come flaring back within a year. So you have to consolidate that remission, get rid of those leftover stem cells. So what happens when we fail? We have refractory or relapse disease. The goals here are to prolong quality of life and prolong survival and improve quality of life. A majority of patients, once they relapse, are not going to be cured. Okay? There's a caveat that some people, if you get them back into a second remission, if their duration of first remission was pretty long, you can get them back into a second remission and then take them to allogeneic transplant. You might be able to salvage a percentage of those, but it's by no means the majority of patients. In this context, we want to think carefully about clinical trials. Think about reinduction with an anthracycline-based regimen, and think about allogeneic autologous stem cell transplant if you think you might be able to cure that patient in a relatively small group of people. So standard AML therapy is induction, which requires admission to the hospital. I didn't say this, but that 7 days of chemotherapy that I talked about that wipes everything out, you have to stay in the hospital for that. And my patients, when I admit them to the hospital, they were perfectly fine. They went in, they thought they had a cold, they went to the ER. Somebody did blood tests. The white count is 100,000. Normal is between 4 and 10,000. All of a sudden, they get emergency rushed over to see me. They're like, it's the middle of the night. They're fine. They didn't bring anything with them. And I tell them they have to stay in the hospital for 4 to 6 weeks. Okay? So that's what we're talking about here. These patients have to stay in the hospital because once they get induction chemotherapy, the mucous membranes can break down. And then because they have no immune system, they can actually die within hours if they don't get appropriate antibiotic therapy. So these patients, they stay in the hospital, they stay in a HEPA-filtered environment, they get prophylactic antibiotics, and if they have a fever, they have to get antibiotics, IV antibiotics, within 1 hour of their fever. Historically, neutropenic fever conferred 100% mortality. These days, we're down to about 1% induction mortality. Okay? So once we have remission, again, absence of leukemia on the bone marrow biopsy, this doesn't equal cure. All patients in remission will require consolidation or an allogeneic transplant. So how do we do? I sort of described this before, but I thought it was worthwhile to put up some curves. It's important to recognize that age makes a significant impact. I told you before, age is an important prognostic factor. When we think about young patients, those less than 60, you can see that all outcomes are actually not terrible, right? So you could argue this is pretty shitty, but you know, it's not zero, right? There's a tail here. We have some people living a long time. This is out to 5 years. By contrast, if you look at those greater than 60 when they show up, these curves tail off pretty significantly, right? We're not doing that well in this group of patients. This is the opportunity. You guys are going to make a difference for us, right? We're going to cure this disease. Exactly. Okay. So one of the things we can do in younger people that we can't do in older people is allogeneic transplant. Now, turns out that actually these days we'll allo transplant anyone, no matter how old they are, if they look good. Okay? Turns out that performance status trumps age. Your physiologic age is much more important than your chronologic age. So we're doing allo transplants 75, 76, 77. Come on, bring it on. Sometimes 80, we talk about it. Scary. This is the only cure for many patients. We do it routinely up front in what we call CR1. Complete response 1 for high-risk patients. We do it up front in any patient who's refractory to initial therapy. We do it in people who have relapse disease and second remission after relapse. Upfront mortality that they'll quote you as you walk in the door, if you're a young person, they're going to say between 10 and 15%. And if I talk to Dr. McCarthy says, that's too harsh, you shouldn't say that, that's too strong. It's more like 10%. If you include up to 5 years, probably at least 20%, I would say, and that's because you get a lot of long-term graft-versus-host disease, which can affect morbidity and mortality, okay? Even if I survive, you know, I have patients who are out many years. Some of them are doing great. They have a little bit of graft-versus-host disease, maybe a little rash. They scratch it every once in a while, no problem. If you have really bad graft-versus-host disease, I have patients who have contractures. They get what looks for all the world like scleroderma skin syndrome, so they get extraordinary tightening of all the skin of their arms and legs. Some people have contractures that mean they can't get up and walk around. Some people have chronic pain, or chronic inflammation of their muscles. These are pretty significant disorders. I saw a patient once who had chronic skin GVHD, and she essentially looked like she had a burn all the time. She had to wrap her legs every day. She was out 10 years from her transplant still with this horrible graft-versus-host disease of the skin. This can actually be potentially life-threatening. So if you take patients, however, who have porous disease, you remember those curves when we looked before, but you can see here, this is allo with reduced intensity conditioning versus a matched bone marrow versus auto versus chemotherapy in intermediate risk disease. What you can see here is that these curves flatten out pretty nicely, whereas this continues to go down. This is out to 60 months with pretty decent follow-up. And so what you can do is you can take patients who tend to have less good survival with chemo alone, and you can upstage them, right? You can give them a little bit of a better chance. So this is more like 60%. This really isn't that bad. And this is actually with reduced intensity conditioning for people who have alternative donor transplants. This is the risk of relapse for patients with intermediate, this is the second, this is the same paper, I believe. You can see here the risk of relapse. So this is overall survival, whereas this is relapse risk. And you can see here chemotherapy alone versus transplant in terms of relapse risk. So this is why we take the risk of doing this incredibly toxic thing. And this is disease-free and overall survival for intermediate and high-risk AML patients who get chemo versus allotransplant. And here you can see allotransplant versus chemotherapy. And you would do this trade all day, right? You'd take this. You'd take this. I'd take this curve over that curve. If I was gambling, I would take that. Now, it's not totally without toxicity, but it's a better chance of being alive and in remission. Okay, so the whole point of this is to inspire you and to hopefully inform you about what things we can do in the lab to really change patient outcomes. And one of the best stories about that, and that I think is coming down the pike in recent years, is the FLT3 story. Okay? So FLT3 is a very important receptor tyrosine kinase. Under normal circumstances, this signaling occurs only in the presence of FLT ligand. Okay? And this receptor occurs mostly on stem cells. So when you have FLT ligand that binds to the receptor tyrosine kinase, causing dimerization of the receptor, and then downstream signaling, which causes cell growth. In leukemias, you can have mutations either within the tyrosine kinase domain or within the juxtamembrane region that creates a receptor whose inner portion, whose active portion, is more floppy than normal. Okay? So what that means is that under normal circumstances, the receptor requires dimerization such that you can phosphorylate each other. Right? But if my arm is incredibly long, I can phosphorylate myself. And then I don't need to dimerize in order to activate myself. And that's exactly what happens in people who have FLT3 ITD positive. You get expansion of this juxtamembrane portion of the receptor tyrosine kinase, and you get autologous activation of the downstream signaling pathway in the absence of binding. So that's this picture here. Okay? This results in constitutive activation of the FLT3 tyrosine kinase pathway, and incredible overwhelming growth. You can see patients whose white counts double and triple overnight. What we know is that patients with ITD mutations in their leukemia tend to do less well. So if you look here, disease-free survival and overall survival, no FLT3 mutations versus FLT3, this is tyrosine kinase domain mutations versus ITD mutations, you can see outcome here. And I would argue that this is probably a little bit understating the degree of problem with FLT3 ITD. What we know now is, in fact, how much FLT3 ITD you have in your leukemia makes a big difference. So if you have a very high allelic burden, if you have very high expression of this mutational event, those patients tend to do incredibly poorly in the absence of a FLT3 inhibitor. So FLT3 inhibitors have been developed based on fundamental understanding of the mechanism of this activity. The result, sorafenib, midostaurin, and many others, has changed the face of this disease. So this is data that was presented this year at ASH. This is the first time we've been able to show that inhibiting FLT3 signaling in patients with AML can improve overall survival. And this is, in fact, censored at the time of allotransplant. And what happened is that about a third of these patients actually all went on to allotransplant, so the curves went out a lot longer. We know that upfront allotransplant in this disease tends to improve survival as well. But what's happened here is the addition of midostaurin, which is a very, very dirty tyrosine kinase inhibitor that hits FLT3, has improved survival. And what you can see here is it's important within each of the subsets. So if you have a TKD mutation, these tend to do a little bit better. But even those patients with a TKD mutation who got midostaurin versus those who got placebo, in those patients who have a low allelic burden ITD mutation, who got midostaurin, they did better than the group who got placebo. If you have an ITD mutation with a high allelic burden, you can see those patients did significantly higher than those that got the placebo. And this is likely to result in the approval of midostaurin for the management of patients with FLT3 ITD positive disease. What I can tell you is that for the last 6 years, all of us who treat this disease as our primary therapy have been giving off-label sorafenib to our patients during induction. Okay? If I didn't have a clinical trial available, I added sorafenib right up front because I believed it was so important. Okay, so we've talked about conventional acute myelogenous leukemia. Those are the things that are going on. That's the translational story that I've told you just then. The story of APL, which I would argue is now considered a different disease than historical, than we think about AML, APL is a disease that historically was characterized by malignant proliferation of immature promyelocytes, blood fills up with these toxin-loaded promyelocytes. They're moody, they're mercurial, they're jumpy. They can release their poisonous granules on a whim and precipitate massive bleeding or stimulate a septic reaction in the body. Most cancers contain cells that refuse to stop growing. In APL, the cancers also refuse to grow up. Historically, actually in the 1950s, there was a position piece that was written by a very famous doctor who said, in fact, that we as doctors, that it was malpractice to treat these patients because every single one of them died, and they all died of overwhelming bleeding. This is the promyelocyte stage. This disease is characterized by a mutation, translocation between chromosomes 15 and 17, that results in a fusion product, the T1517 mutation. And the result of that mutational event is a dominant negative PML protein. Okay? That dominant negative PML protein results in a maturation arrest at the promyelocyte stage. And it turns out that if you degrade that protein, you can cause the cells to grow up. So there are two things that we know do that. The first is retinoic acid, or all trans retinoic acid, or vesinoids. And the second thing is arsenic. Okay? This drug binds to the mutated, to the fusion protein, and changes its conformation such that it releases its partners, and then the result is that the cells grow up. Arsenic binds to the fusion protein and causes its degradation, proteasomal degradation. So think about arsenic, you think about this as rat poison. This is true, same thing. We give it to patients at very low dose. It causes quite a significant amount of toxicity. A lot of cardiac toxicity, a lot of people can get actually really crazy with this. But it really works. They cause degradation of this PML RARA fusion protein, and it just changed the face of this disease. So I told you before, this disease historically was universally fatal. This is the survival curve now, okay? And this is with what we call double differentiation therapy, ATRA plus arsenic given up front, and ATRA plus arsenic given as a consolidation. These patients never get conventional chemotherapies anymore. 10, 15 years ago, we gave ATRA with an anthracycline. Again, remember, anthracyclines can cause 11Q23 mutations. They can cause secondary acute leukemia. They have real toxicity. If you get this when you're young, there's a significant risk if I give you chemo, you get something else, something secondary. If I give you double differentiation therapy, by contrast, you don't see any real chemo. All you've seen is arsenic and ATRA. Those patients do extraordinarily well. And we've now started moving this into the upfront treatment of patients with high-risk APL as well. That's really changed things. And that's something that was essentially viewed as a Chinese medicine discovery, right? So we knew that in vitro, if you gave ATRA to cells in the lab, that it would cause differentiation. And there was this young girl who was hospitalized, who had failed all other therapies. And there was a very clever doctor who said, you know what, I've read some stuff in the lab about how maybe this could differentiate cells. Can we try it? And her parents signed off on it. The patient was dying. She was a kid. She got this drug, and she's still alive today. Right? I mean, that puts a chill down your back. That's what's possible if we understand the mechanism of the disease. So MDS, this is actually a different disease. But I want to argue with you that this is, in fact, a slow-growing acute myeloid leukemia, okay? People think about MDS as a pre-leukemia. Where are we for time? Doing okay? This is a clonal hematopoietic stem cell disease, which is characterized by dysplasia and ineffective hematopoiesis. It's characterized by pancytopenia. Patients present with low peripheral blood counts. Patients get infections and bleeding. They often are transfusion-dependent. A third of patients will die of transformation to acute myeloid leukemia. A third of patients will die as a result of infections, and a third of patients will die as a result of bleeding. If you have good risk MDS, your median survival is 6 or 7 years. If you have poor risk MDS, your median survival is 6 months in the absence of therapy. We prognosticate in this disease using clinical and biologic characteristics of the disease. So a majority of us now use what we call the revised international prognostic scoring system. And this is based largely on cytogenetics used as a molecular basis of the disease. So again, remembering cytogenetics, very important recognition. And we divide these cytogenetic groups into what we call very good, good, intermediate, poor, and very poor. And you can read them here. We look at the bone marrow blast percentage. So remember, in AML, you have to have more than 20% blasts to make that diagnosis. In MDS, you have more than what's normal. And what's normal is a little bit variable, might be between 2 and 3% in a normal patient, probably 1 or 2%. In patients with MDS, these people often will have an increased percentage of blasts, so somewhere between 3, 4, 5, 6, up to 20. And we grade those in the marrow, and we put them on this scale. The other thing that's important is your clinical symptomatology, so how anemic are you? How low is your hemoglobin? Are you transfusion dependent or not? How low are your platelets? Turns out that if your platelet count is lower, you're more likely to die of bleeding. Not surprising, right? Historically, these weren't included in the prognostic scoring systems, but now they're included as a standard approach, and so we look at patients who have platelets greater than 100,000. They almost never bleed. People with platelets between 50 and 100,000, they can bleed sometimes, but not often. Platelets less than 50, and when we're talking about these patients, they're often very low, so sometimes they're less than 5. Those patients tend to bleed more, and so we give that a point system. And then we look at the neutrophil counts. So patients who have very low neutrophil counts, less than 800, they tend to be more likely to have infections, more likely to have infectious complications, so therefore more likely to die. So we give that a point as well. And then we divide here, right? So what you can see here is patients with what we call very low risk disease, their median survival was about 9 years here. Patients with low risk disease, their median survival about 5 years. Intermediate risk disease, about 3 years. Very high risk disease, 0.8 years, okay? About 6 months, slightly more than 6 months. So historically, people used to say this was a pre-leukemia or this was something you could just watchfully wait on. I think we now understand a lot more that this is a disease that can be actually quite devastating and have a prognosis that's similar to leukemia. And when you play out these curves, you can see this. And they're not reassuring, right? Nobody in this room would like to be given this curve, even this good one, right? We call this good. I'm not super happy about this either. But it turns out that clinical factors are not all the story here. It turns out, in fact, that molecular mutational events can actually contribute in terms of prognostication. So we use this clinical scoring system, but in the last 5 to 10 years, we've also identified that small point mutations can confer important information about our patients. So this is something that we're identifying first in terms of prognosis. But I think that this will form the basis for us, for our ability to target these diseases in the future, right? This is where you guys have an opportunity to make a difference. So if you look at mutational events, patients with no mutations tend to do better than patients with lots of mutations. That's kind of not surprising, right? It says something about the biology of the disease, how careful the genetic machinery is working. This is with no mutations versus many driver mutations. And these are relatively large numbers of patients. And if you add that to the scoring system that I described to you before, right, if you add that to your clinical prognostic scoring system, it turns out that you can upstage the patients. So if you have patients, oh, this didn't work very well. Okay, so if you have patients who have low risk disease, I don't know why this is beeping. if you have low risk disease and then you add a mutational, the information about mutations, you can actually upstage that group of patients from the low risk curve to an intermediate risk curve. And if you have intermediate one risk disease and you add a mutational profile on this using these just five mutations, you can upstage that patient to the next highest curve. And then if you have intermediate two, you can actually upstage them to the same as high risk disease. And that sort of tells you something about the biology of the disease, and it's very useful for us. And why is it useful though? So it's really useful because it tells you what you should do the patient. If the patient has a median survival of 8 to 10 years and they're 80, you probably can just watch that patient. You don't need to do anything. Especially if they're in good shape, you can just watch them over time. So supportive care, that forms a huge amount of what we do for these patients. We say, okay, well, we know you have this problem. We're going to watch you. We're going to maybe improve your hemoglobin by giving you a growth factor like erythropoietin. These days, we might add a thrombopoietin growth factor to improve your platelet count. If you have higher risk disease, intermediate two or high risk disease, we tend to give people hypomethylating agents. We don't fully understand exactly how these work, but we think that they work by encouraging the cells to grow up and do their job more effectively. The drugs azacitidine and decitabine are FDA approved for this indication. For younger patients who have intermediate or high risk disease, an allogeneic transplant is appropriate up front. It turns out that there was a really nice study done by one of my colleagues at the Dana-Farber where he looked at patients and he said, well, it turns out because transplant is so toxic, if you have somebody with really low risk disease, you probably should wait on that patient because they're going to progress. And then transplant them when they start to progress, right? And that way you get the maximum bang for all of your therapeutic buck. I think this thing has died. I think the battery may have died. It's not working anymore. Okay. You
that or the whole company. No, there we go. So then you can see the picture of a bone marrow. And this is how we think the hypomethylating drugs work. We think they work by getting incorporated in the place of cytidine, right? And then depleting intracellular DNMTs, and then inducing expression of genes that have been silenced by the cancer. What you can see here is the difference in survival that happens when you give intermediate two or high-risk patients azacitidine versus what we called conventional care. So historically, these patients either got treatment like acute myeloid leukemia, induction chemo like I talked about, 4 to 6 weeks in the hospital, or they would get low-dose cytarabine sub-Q outpatient, or they would just get transfusions. And it turns out that if you take all comers with high-risk disease and you randomize them according to what the doctor said, so the doctor gets to say, okay, I'm going to do this, and then they unblind it and half of those people get what the doctor said and half of those people get the azacitidine, that you can improve survival by giving azacitidine compared with conventional care by about 10 months. All right? And that's why this drug is now the standard of care in this disease. The second drug that we often use, and actually, so when you think about azacitidine, this drug was actually originally developed in the 1960s. It was developed as a competitor for cytarabine, so induction chemo, high-dose chemotherapy. And it was given at very high dose, and it caused a lot of GI toxicity, and actually it lost out to cytarabine in terms of being the driving force of induction chemotherapy. But it was reevaluated in the 80s because it was given in vitro to a dish of cells, and it caused them to differentiate into a particular subtype of cells, into myocytes. And as a result of this observation by Peter Jones and Shirley Taylor that happened in the mid-80s, we reassessed the role of this drug as potentially a valuable therapy in a disease where there really was nothing in MDS. And that's what prompted its approval. So the other drug that we use is a drug that had historically been sort of vilified as the drug thalidomide. So the thalidomide analog, lenalidomide, was developed for therapy of patients with chromosome 5 abnormalities. It turns out that for a long time, we really didn't know how this drug worked. We called it an immune modulator. We called it a lot of things. It certainly works in patients with multiple myeloma. It also works in patients with this so-called deletion 5q MDS. It was actually FDA approved without us knowing really the mechanism of action, based on phase 3 data that showed improvements in red blood cell transfusions, but really no improvement in survival. So you can see here, this is the phase 3 trial with 3 arms. All the arms did relatively well. Unfortunately, but there was no significant change in the survival pattern. Now again, deletion 5q patients tend to have more indolent disease. They tend to be ranked in the low risk AML category, so they tend to be, or low risk MDS category, so they tend to live 4 or 5 or 6 years. And this drug can really be magical for them because they're no longer transfusion dependent. But it doesn't really prolong survival. These days, and this is data that was published in the journal Nature, in 2 years ago, I think. What they found actually is that how this drug works is by altering protein degradation, right? So it's a way of targeting proteins, and it turns out that IKZF1 and IKZF2 are abnormally expressed in patients with 5q minus MDS. And by targeting this drug for degradation, for protease amyl degradation, you can actually improve therapy in these patients. And it turns out that the distinction in terms of response with thalidomide versus lenalidomide is based on which proteins are targeted for degradation. And it's this insight that's resulted in a huge resurgence of enthusiasm for focusing on protein degradation as a novel therapeutic target. So I think that in summary, what we know is that we still have a lot to learn, but better understanding of the underpinnings of leukemia have resulted in improved therapies for patients and also are continuing to result in improvements in outcome for our patients. Bench-to-bedside collaborations really form the underpinning of this, and I think there's a huge amount of new stuff to be done, and as we begin to learn the vocabulary and the alphabet, as it were, for how these things work by doing deep sequencing and by better understanding the molecular mechanisms of the disease, we're going to have better insights and better therapies for our patients. And with that, I'm going to hand off to Dr. Nemeth, who's going to talk a little bit about some of the work we've done in the lab to better understand acute leukemia.
You got eight.
Are there any questions? All right, where am I? Okay. Okay, so as Elizabeth just mentioned, there's still a lot to learn. And what I wanted to talk about over the next maybe half hour or so is about a recent project that we've been doing here at Roswell Park, studying some of the basic mechanisms that underlie AML biology. And the reason I thought it was a very interesting project is because it utilizes some of the resources that are fairly specialized here at Roswell. And sort of our overall approach is based on a slide that she showed near the beginning of her talk, where the hematopoietic stem cell resides at the apex of a hierarchy of differentiation into all the blood cell lineages. And it turns out that a lot of the features of the hematopoietic stem cell, which include things like self-renewal, relative inhibited differentiation, and relative resistance to cytotoxic stresses, are actually features that a cancer cell can really take advantage of. And so it turns out that a lot of the basic molecular pathways that are activated in stem cells are also turned on in cancer cells. And this makes sense, because when a cancer cell is during the process of transformation, these cells don't rewire pathways to come up with what they need. They just usually turn on pathways that are kind of lying dormant. And what I started on is a project I brought with me from my postdoc, is looking at the roles of the Wnt signaling pathway in stem cell biology and in AML. And you may have had some of this stuff before, especially if you had electron colon cancer. But what I want to do is just kind of set the groundwork. You know, basically everyone has the same foundation of the Wnt pathway, and then to go on to some of the work that Elizabeth and I did in looking and targeting this pathway in AML. So to kind of start off from the very beginning, let me just see, is this, sorry, is there a clicker? So, Wnt ligands, Wnt comes from, is a portmanteau word coming from the combination of wingless and intron 1. And intron 1, I'll explain a little bit later on. Wingless is fairly self-explanatory. This is what mutations in this pathway, this is the phenotype in Drosophila. They don't have wings. And so the combination of this is what gives you Wnt as the nomenclature. There are 19 of these ligands in mammals. And these are fairly small lipid-modified glycoproteins. They are heavily post-translationally modified, both by palmitoylation and end-link glycosylation, to regulate their activity and their secretion. And these ligands basically co-evolved with multicellularity. About 650 million years ago is when when they start to develop. And so these ligands basically regulate everything. They regulate development, differentiation, proliferation, apoptosis. So these are basic fundamental processes. They also regulate specialized cellular processes in individual cells. And to kind of give you a sense, there's about 24,000 papers on the subject in PubMed. And just this year alone, we've already published about 1,200. So that's about 10 papers on the subject per day. So if you're studying this field, there is almost a 100% chance you're going to get scooped on any given moment. So that's a bit, that's kind of why, the good thing is that it's a very high impact field, but the downside is that someone's definitely doing what you're doing. So to kind of sort of simplify this, the one pathway I'm going to focus on is how Wnt signals through what is called the canonical signaling pathway. And it's termed canonical because it was really the first one that was described. These Wnt ligands actually can activate up to a dozen different signaling pathways, but this is the pathway that appears to be most important in cancer and in AML. So, So at the cell surface, there is the Wnt ligand receptor, which is called frizzled. And that is usually complex to a co-receptor from the LRP5 or LRP6 family. And so in the absence of any Wnt ligand binding to this receptor-co-receptor complex, what you have is the formation of a sort of a destruction complex in which this beta-catenin protein is biochemically interacts with other scaffolding proteins, including AXIN1, GSK3 beta or glycogen synthase kinase 3 beta, and APC. And those, I picked AXIN1 and APC for reasons that will come to in later slides. Actually, I've probably left out also another half dozen proteins that are important in this process. But this is, for the purposes of this talk, this, I think, simplifies it. And when this complex is intact, the glycogen synthase kinase phosphorylates beta-catenin, and the beta-catenin is then earmarked for degradation. However, when the Wnt ligand is bound to that complex, what happens is this entire destruction complex gets sequestered at the cell surface. And what this does is it prevents then, so even though this complex is still intact, this then prevents degradation of beta-catenin. And so what then occurs is that beta-catenin is rapidly being transcribed and translated. It's actually transcribed in all cells. And what happens is the newly synthesized beta-catenin can then translocate to the nucleus, where it interacts with members of the TCF-LEF family to induce target gene expression. And the genes that are turned on include genes such as c-MYC, which is a known oncogene, cyclin D1, which is important for proliferation, survivin, which is an anti-apoptotic protein, twist, which is an important gene in the epithelial to mesenchymal transformation, and you know, and a host of others. And so actually, abnormal activation of this pathway is almost uniformly pro-oncogenic. So just to kind of reiterate this, the canonical Wnt pathway in cancer, as I said, what that intron 1 actually stands for is, where they came out with the Wnt nomenclature, stands for Wnt1. This gene was originally cloned out because a mouse mammary tumor virus preferentially localized to the first intron of the Wnt1 ligand. And by doing so, it induced abnormal secretion of this ligand, which resulted in activation of the pathway and the development of a mouse mammary tumor. Some of the, in general cancer, APC, which is a member of that destruction complex, it was first described as a gene that was mutated in about 80% of colon cancer cells. If any of you have seen sort of the Bert Vogelstein called the Vogelgram, where they show different mutations at different stages of cancer, colon cancer progression, APC is almost uniformly mutated. And it was actually, that was described first, and when they went back, they found out that the loss of function of APC is what turns on activated Wnt signaling by interfering with the formation of that destruction complex. Most of the mutations in this pathway in cancer are found in APC and in the beta-catenin gene itself. And so these are mutations that block its phosphorylation, therefore prevent its degradation. Two of the cancers with higher mutation rates include liver and uterine endometrial cancer. It's about 20%. But there are many different tumors that have sort of between 5 to 10% of mutations of this gene. Prostate cancer is what I put up here, but pancreatic cancer, neuroblastomas, these all have sort of a low level of beta-catenin mutations. Interestingly, no mutations in this pathway are found in AML. And it turns out that this pathway can be activated independent of mutations. And so not only in AML, but in other solid tumors, you'll see the presence of the pathways activated even though there's no mutations in any of the genes. And not surprisingly, with the path set of the pathway that co-evolved with cellularity, there's a substantial amount of crosstalk with other pathways. And I did not, you know, for the sake of clarity, I decided not to go into that, but really to kind of go into something interesting in AML, which is that you get epigenetic regulation of the different regulatory factors. And generally, this involves in hypermethylation or silencing of expression of pathways factors that normally suppress the Wnt signaling pathway, but when they lose their expression, the pathway gets activated. So these are just four examples that we have sort of looked at in some of our studies, and this is by no means an exhaustive list, but just to kind of get to a sense that how all the different levels in which this pathway is regulated. So So sort of at the first level is you prevent Wnt ligand from binding at all. And that is what, and that could happen through a number of different factors. So one is what is called soluble frizzled receptor protein. So this is basically a soluble form of this frizzled receptor that acts as a decoy. The Wnt ligand binds to it so you don't get binding. There's another protein called WIF, or Wnt inhibitory factor, again, binds to the Wnt ligand. And if you have sufficient levels of these proteins present, even if you're making lots of Wnt ligand, it won't bind to this and you won't get downstream activation. Another protein that sort of complexes with Wnt ligands and these other co-receptor receptor complexes called DKK or DKOF. And again, this is an analogous pathway suppressor in which when you have this factor around, you do get formation of the Wnt ligand and the co-receptor receptor complexes, but again, it prevents the necessary conformational shifts to allow the downstream pathway activation. So that's sort of at the outside of the cell. There's, of course, stuff that goes on in the nucleus. So, for example, there's a protein called SOC17 that, when it's highly expressed, it blocks this interaction between beta-catenin and TCF. And when you don't have this interaction, you don't get transcription from these factors, and that way that suppresses target gene expression. And another way of doing this in the nucleus is RUNX3, which basically complexes this whole, which complexes with the beta-catenin TCF and also blocks target gene expression. What's really kind of interesting in AML, and for reasons that I will speculate on but haven't been demonstrated, is that you may have noticed that the sort of the main sources of where you can dysregulate the pathway are at the site of, at the sort of at the cell interface level and at the nucleus level, but not in that destruction complex, which is mutated in all of the other solid tumor types. And there's really no evidence as to why that is, but my speculation is that it's been demonstrated that actually activation of Wnt signaling in hematopoiesis is actually very, very subtle to have a profound effect. As in twofold versus threefold gives you completely different outcomes. Twofold, you get enhanced self-renewal. Threefold, things start to die. And so my own personal speculation based on just based on no evidence, but just in reading the literature, suggests that maybe when you start to target some of that destruction complexes in AML, that you get too much Wnt signaling, and the cell just ends up, it's just too much for the cell to handle, and the cell just dies. But when you have some of these more subtle dysregulations, that sort of puts the Wnt signaling in a sweet spot, which then can go on to provide some of the stem cell to sort of enhance the stem cell-like phenotype that you get with the other transformation events. And the reason again, we focus on those pathways is, so this is a project that Elizabeth did back when she was a postdoc at Johns Hopkins, where she studied 72 patients with normal karyotype AML. They all were uniformly treated with induction chemotherapy. And what these what she was looking for is the presence of DNA methylation of the promoters of these genes, resulting in some, their suppression of their expression. And did that was that associated with poor outcomes? And to sum up a lot of work that she did in one figure, as we always do, there were three genes that kind of really were very interesting. So SFRP2 and 5. Where suppression of these genes was associated with increased probability of relapse, and methylation of SFRP2 was associated with an increased risk of death from the disease. And we should note that this is what she observed in her study. Other groups looking at other patient cohorts kind of saw similar results. Sometimes they saw, DKK had a more important role, WIF1 had a more important role. As Elizabeth has kind of alluded to, AML, we call it AML, but it's actually a very heterogeneous disease depending on the karyotype, the source of mutations, et cetera. And so I think a lot of these I think what you'll see is if you really parse out the different populations, that you might see that the different genes are involved in very specific subtypes of the disease. And so, of course, based on that, you know, one of the a good question, of course, is why is this such a potential interesting drug target? Is that it turns out that this canonical Wnt beta-catenin pathway, this was a lot of work that other groups, including ours, kind of looked at, and we found that this pathway, even though it confers some stem cell-like properties on the hematopoietic stem cell, it's actually dispensable for their normal function. However, nicely, it is indispensable for AML. But that was based, and we'll get a little bit into this later on, but that was based on a lot of mouse genetic studies. But initially, it was thought that, you know, this pathway is dispensable for normal cells, indispensable for AML. Great, that can give you a therapeutic window. And sort of in agreement with some of Elizabeth's data, beta-catenin levels correlated with increased relapse rates. So in this study here, what this group from France simply looked at is patients looked and basically looked at beta-catenin negative versus beta-catenin positive based on whether or not the protein was there. And what they observed was that in both relapse-free and in overall survival, at the presence of beta-catenin-expressing blasts conferred a poorer prognosis. And this is not only, this may be both causal in that activation of Wnt signaling, as I said, has a anti-apoptotic, so you can understand that these cells may be more resistant to cytotoxic agents. Also, it may have to do with the fact that it may also be a bit of a biomarker indicating that those cells that were beta-catenin positive, that they get transformed, are cells that are more likely to establish more aggressive leukemia. I think that the jury's a little bit out on that. So to kind of go into a little bit more detail about this in AML, to kind of sum up these major points, is that in genetic models, uniformly prevents development of AML. Haven't seen one yet where if you knock out beta-catenin, the mice still get AML. But of course, mice are not humans, and so knockdown of beta-catenin in human AML cell lines suppress their proliferation and in vivo growth in xenotransplant models, okay? Cell lines, however, are not actual patients, and it turns out that in this paper, this Gandile et al. From London showed that knockdown of beta-catenin in primary human AML had a variable effect, in that some samples with high levels of beta-catenin, they were susceptible to the knockdown of the gene, however, some grew just fine. And so with this kind of, raises the point that, it is likely that identifying the stage or type of AML where targeting this signaling pathway will have the most benefit is going to be an important step going forward. And the reason this is important is because, therapeutic inhibitors of Wnt signaling are progressing towards clinical application. I mean, so APC, I mean, that mutation has been known for decades. And so there's been tremendous interest in targeting this pathway in cancer. But it's difficult because, as I said, it regulates everything. If you do a fairly 100% pleiotropic knockdown of Wnt signaling, you are probably going to have multi-organ failure because it regulates so many different organ systems. And so they've, rather than going through these brute force approaches, there's been a tremendous improvement in Wnt signaling inhibitors to get a therapeutic window. Some of these are currently in clinical trial. So this fourth point is actually, I think, a very interesting avenue for future research because before it was more of a basic science, but now I think there's some real potential translational applications for it. So what did we do here specifically at Roswell? So that previous paper, as I mentioned, just looked at beta-catenin levels. But critically, what's important for this pathway is that it's actually in the nucleus. And so if it's lots of beta-catenin but not in the nucleus, that's not really activation of the pathway. And so some of you may have seen, if any of you have been up to the flow cytometer facility here, they have this great instrument called the ImageStream that basically combines basic flow parameters with the addition of visual images and microscopy. So what you could do is you could take a leukemia sample and subject it to flow cytometry like they do for the diagnosis, as Elizabeth mentioned, but then you can also detect the cellular localization of a specific protein in defined populations. And so, for example, what we'll be talking about today, and it's called a similarity score. And this is an algorithm that basically quantifies the co-localization between beta-catenin, which will be in green, and a nuclear stain, so that's just the cell nucleus, or DAPI. So, for example, to show you what the score looks like, so this would be an example of a cell that has a highly negative similarity score. So here is the beta-catenin, pretty much at the cell membrane in the cytoplasm, nothing really in the nucleus, it's pretty fairly blue, but then as you get increasingly higher similarity score, you can start to see the overlap of the blue and the green signals. And just to kind of show you that, this one slide, DAPI's in red, but just kind of show you how this actually works, is so these are KG1A cells. And in these cells, beta-catenin is actually largely at the cell membrane surface. I should mention, historically, beta-catenin is part of the cell, part of cell adhesion complexes as well as a transcriptional regulator. So that's probably the source of this fairly large green signal. Here's DAPI in red, and then we look at this by ImageStream, you see almost no overlap. When we treat it with a recombinant Wnt ligand, you can see, can already appreciate substantial amounts of beta-catenin throughout the cell, and nice overlap of the beta-catenin and DAPI signal. So this is what, this is kind of our control experiment to show that Wnt ligands turns on the pathway by inducing the accumulation and nuclear localization of beta-catenin. All right. So how do you actually do this then of AML samples? And this was a lot of work that was conducted by a former master's student of mine, Michelle Golding. AML blasts basically have the properties, this is one example of a patient, AML blasts kind of have the properties of low side scatter and low expression of CD45. So for example, in this plot, they're right about here. If you had mature myeloid cells, they would show up right around here. These are going to be mature lymphoid cells, so CD4, CD8 positive T cells and B cells. So these are your blasts right here. And when we kind of looked at and calculated the median similarity score, it was, here is sort of, like I said, here's where, it's about zero. Here's where you would see more beta-catenin localization. Here you would see less. The median score was about 0.6, negative 0.67. And when you actually look at what one of these representative cell that median score looks up under the scope, this is what you can kind of see. So around here, you see beta-catenin. Again, largely a little pocket here is probably cytoplasm, some around the cell membrane. Here is the DAPI nucleus, and you can see here, not much overlap. And so what Michelle did is she looked at a whole series of patients. So these are normal karyotype patients. They are FLT3 ITD negative, and the reason we chose that is, like I said, we wanted to look at a fairly, at the time, which was a reasonably homogeneous population. I think as we've since have gone on to learn that this, even by those standards, this was a fairly heterogeneous population, but we wanted to get rid of as many known confounding factors from induction of signaling pathways as possible, just really focus on beta-catenin in these normal karyotype AMLs. And you can already see here that if these are mostly cells with inactive Wnt signaling as measured by the localization of beta-catenin, here are mostly the positives, it's a pretty wide range. Slight majority probably have active Wnt signaling. So that is, kind of looking at it at sort of one level. To look at it at a more complex level, we then decided to look at a more enriched population of our AML samples. And so, as Elizabeth mentioned, again in that slide, stem cells and progenitor cells sort of are at the apex of this hierarchy, and one of the markers of that is CD34. So again, Michelle took a sample. Here's your AML blast population based on 45 inside scatter. And then we looked at CD34, the 34 positive fraction. And so in this case, you know, in the 34 positive blasts, you saw a nice robust similarity score of 0.87, so that's largely nuclear translocated beta-catenin. And again, that's something you can appreciate here. So here's your beta-catenin signal throughout the cell. Here's DAPI. This is CD34 in purple, which kind of, as a cell membrane marker, goes around the edge. And when you merge it all, you can see that pretty much the beta-catenin signal is largely interacting with the nucleus. So that's this was a substantial. I mean, I've basically taken a year and a half of Michelle's life and compressed it down to 5 minutes to show you this to get this working. But this is something that's fairly unique to Roswell Park. This is about $500,000 instrument that not too many institutes have. And if they do, they don't use it to the same frequency we do. So, you know, when she presented these data at national meetings, people were always very interested in these data because this is such a powerful approach, because mostly what you would have to do to get something like this is you would have to sort out these cells, stain them, and then count them on a slide. And with this way, you don't have to do any of that, and you just get a sort of a blind number that the software gives you, so there's limited bias, and so that just improves the quality of the data. So when we kind of start to graph all those 21 patient samples, what we ended up seeing was about, so if this axis is that sort of beta-catenin localization in the 34 positive leukemia stem and progenitor cells on this axis, that's from less translocation to more translocation, and sort of the overall blast population. Again, there was kind of this over, what we ended up observing was this overall trend of, if you saw nuclear translocation in the 34 positive cells, you tended to see it in the overall blast population as well. And it really kind of looked at, there was almost three different populations that showed up, this high population, sort of a median population, and then this scattered low population. And so the question, of course, would be: if these were patients, you would ideally target them with anti-Wnt therapies, assuming some were on the market. Not so sure about this population. And another question that would be is: what is the prognosis for these patients? Are in this normal karyotype population, could we further segregate these patients based on these parameters? And that may, in itself, dictate some of the therapeutic choices. The other thing that we also noticed is that increased numbers of 34 positive blasts, just in general, were associated with increased levels of nuclear beta-catenin. So again, you see this population out here, which is mostly with the higher translocation of beta-catenin. You kind of saw this smaller population in here, and probably another third population in here. I think this is kind of how I would draw the clustering at this point. More samples would be necessary. What is kind of interesting is that these patients are almost uniformly, so even though all these patients are normal karyotype, these patients all are NPM1 wild type, which actually have a worse prognosis than these patients, which are largely NPM1 mutant. And so a very interesting hypothesis to test is that would there be an association between increased Wnt signaling and the presence of a wild-type NPM1 protein. And that's, if anyone's interested, we've got the samples. Feel free to stop by the lab and express your desires. So just for this slide, what we wanted to also confirm is, like I said, we had the pathway getting activated in most of the cells, in a lot of the cells. And actually what we said, we were unable to find sort of a uniform mechanism that explained activation in these pathways. It was maybe some of them was probably epigenetic inactivation, but for others it probably was some of the crosstalk with other pathways that we haven't looked at. But one thing we did want to test is to see whether or not this pathway was intact in some of these more cells that showed very low levels of nuclear beta-catenin. And so this is an example of one patient that we showed here, where what we did is we took the beach cells and cultured them for 6 days in an in vitro system and kind of just wanted to stimulate the pathway to see what would happen. And so this showed up a lot better on my computer screen, but bear with me. So this is sort of the control, and so after you sort of culture the AML blast for about 6 days, what you see is upregulation of these differentiation markers, CD11B and CD14. So these are markers that are upregulated on maturing myeloid cells. And so about 11% of these cells were negative for these markers, so these are more immature blasts. However, when we cultured it with a stimulator of the beta-catenin pathway, we blocked that differentiation. Expectedly, you'd also expect the converse of this. You'd expect to see upregulation or increased numbers of cells with a stem and progenitor cell marker. And again, in the controls, you saw very little expression of CD34, but with this Wnt ligand, you saw an increase. It ended up being a significant increase. About 5% of the cells were immature. And so in this patient sample, even though it doesn't have a lot of beta-catenin signaling, the pathway is still active. And that's actually really important for this next, because of this next slide. That was one of the samples that when we looked at, for about 10 of these patients, we had a paired relapse sample. And when we did a pairwise analysis, including of that patient sample I described, there was a significant increase in both overall blasts and overall CD34 positive cells in the nuclear localization of beta-catenin. This isn't surprising, really. This is actually something that has been seen from in other groups' genetic studies as well, the idea that if you have relapsed AML, you have increased activation of the Wnt pathway, which makes sense because, again, you're seeing increased acquisition of some of those stem cell phenotypes, self-renewal, resistance to stresses that are, that help to make these cells so difficult to treat. And it's probably a contributing factor as to when these patients relapse, as to why their disease is so difficult to treat. So the last couple of slides, as I mentioned at the beginning, is that we're starting to get better at targeting Wnt beta-catenin signaling. And there's actually three drugs I'm going to describe briefly here. So to kind of revisit the pathway, if you have Wnt ligand, this complex comes back, you get degradation, but then the protein is able to translocate to the nucleus. So there's one drug that's in clinical trials called C59. And what this is an inhibitor, again, thanks to the Drosophila folks for naming, of a gene called porcupine. And what porcupine does is porcupine is responsible for some of those post-translational modifications of Wnt ligands that are so important for their bioactivity. And so this is something that is acting at the cell surface by decreasing the ability of Wnt ligand to bind. Wnt ligands, if you block this out, can still bind, so you're not completely abolishing the pathway, but you are suppressing it. And this is something that's been shown in some in vivo models to have some efficacy, I think a prostate cancer, and I think it's in clinical trials now. Another drug called XAV939 is an inhibitor of a protein called tankerase. And this is something, and the tankerase is an enzyme that regulates, regulates protein degradation. And what this tankerase does is when you inhibit this protein, you get increased amounts of axin 1. You get increased amounts of axin 1 to enhance beta-catenin degradation. So you get this complex forms more efficiently and is less susceptible to Wnt ligand signalings. The drug we're going to talk about a little bit today is a drug called ICRT3. And the reason we like this drug is that this was found to block this interaction between beta-catenin and the transcription factors. So the reason we like this is that this is downstream of anything. So because this is sort of the choke point or the business end of Wnt signaling, anything upstream, so no matter how the pathway gets turned on, whether it's some mutation, epigenetic, crosstalk, whatever, it all has to come down to this point. So we want to inhibit it right here. And so what we did was we cultured a series of samples. And so this is kind of just recapitulating some of that earlier data. So this is patient 18, which had fairly high levels of nuclear localization of beta-catenin. This is a relapse sample, which had even higher. And this was a patient that had kind of negative VOTs. So after about 6 days in culture, with the presence of this drug, so that's the dark gray here, and control is
the light gray, not black. This is the expansion of cell numbers. You can see patient 18 really took off, but there was a real significant inhibition of cell expansion. To a lesser extent with the relapse sample and with the negative beta catenin sample, but there's probably, and so some of this may be due to specificity, again, at this drug, and explaining the difference between patient 18 here and patient 8 based on beta catenin levels. There's probably also some off-target cytotoxicity effects. What was kind of interesting, though, was these panels. So if you recall from a few slides earlier, I showed that activation of this pathway leads to downregulation of differentiation markers. And so if you block the pathway, you'd expect to see upregulation. And what was interesting is that for this patient here, which had nuclear, this patient right here, you saw, again, a significant increase in the amount of sort of maturing AML cells. With this relapse sample, it's trending, perhaps a slight increase. Patient 8, no effect at all. But then what was interesting is that, as I said, you'd like to see the converse, is that if you see upregulation of this, you'd expect to see decreased numbers of hematopoietic serum progenitors, cells with a stem as progenitor cell marker. That's actually not what we saw in this patient. Again, it either, we saw actually a number of cells that still retain the expression of this 33rd4 positive marker, and there's absolutely no effect in the other two patient samples. So the question is, how do you interpret this kind of gamish of data? Part of it is that it's clear that this inhibitor has variable effects. That's kind of what we're seeing with the genetic studies, so that kind of recapitulates that. What you're probably seeing, again, is that the effect appears to be preferential on cells that have high levels of nuclear beta catenin as opposed to low levels, which is, of course, expected based on the known mechanism of action of this drug. The relapse form appears to be, is trending towards more resistant than the diagnostic form. To really test that, you need to have paired samples, which we did not have for this project, but that's perhaps not surprising because you might think that a relapse sample has picked up additional mutations or has additional pathways being turned on that may complement or rescue the effects of blocking this pathway. Finally, which is kind of interesting, is that, and this kind of gets at to something Elizabeth alluded to, is that we're starting to appreciate that there are substantial clonal heterogeneity of AML, and that it's not just one population. It could be 5 or 6 different popular clones. And what is entirely possible is that for this patient, that some subset of clones differentiates in response to blocking Wnt signaling, but some populations do not. And so this is, again, something that's very interesting. It speaks to the variability of targeting this pathway. But, what it's probably going to refer to is that, Wnt signaling blocking this pathway could probably help for this population, but for these resistant cells, you're going to need something else. And whether that's standard induction chemotherapy, FLT3-TD mutated inhibitor, some of the other, half dozen small molecule inhibitors that are coming online is a open area investigation. All right. So to kind of sort of sum up, that treatment of primary human AML, has a variable effect. What's going to be very interesting to do is to determine the effect on paired diagnostic versus the relapse samples. Identify the potential for resistant subpopulations. And the critical thing is, of course, testing alternate inhibitors. Sample availability kind of precluded it, but, I think that was one version of the drug, and it is entirely possible that blocking the pathway at other points may for certain either subpopulations or even specific patients may end up being more effective. So that's kind of a picture of what some of the translational work we're doing at Roswell, kind of combining some of the new discoveries in stem cell biology with AML therapies. And this is something, like I said, it was a bit of data that between the excellent leukemia procurement bank we have here and the technical resources of the flow cytometry, this is research that could not have been done at many other institutes here. So, I guess Elizabeth and I are done with our presentation. We're happy to stick around for some
questions if anyone has any, and thank you. Thank you.